Good evening, everyone. And I don't know, some of you may be good may late in the evening or early in the afternoon. So thank you for joining. This is session two of module 12, Wisdom of Emptiness. So before we start, if you're able to... If you're able to do a prostration on your own, that is fine. And if not, and you're seated, at least mentally... offer your prostration. And basically, I tell every class, you are not prostrating to someone. You are basically humbling yourself so the teachings can come to you. And you're basically even saying, at one point I've read, you're saying, I need this, give it to me, right? So you are doing that. Besides, I said, third point, it's good for your stomach if you're bowing down in prostration. So take your time, but do three prostrations. And what we say is we do 4 points, top here, right here, here, and heart area, and then go back up, right? So Om Namo Manju Shriye, Namo Su Shriye, Namo Uttama Shriye, Soha. Om Namo Manju Shriye, Namo Su Shriye, Namo Uttama Shriye, Soha. And thank you for that. So let's just bring our mind to this session, and we'll start as usual with a little breathing, calm abiding meditation. It does two things. It not only calms us down, brings us to the present, however, it also is great for your training for your concentration, right? So let's just sit in a comfortable position. We'll just do a short breathing meditation. Okay. The key points for those, this is first time, you want to have your back straight, okay? Not too tight, but straight. Maybe a little leaning forward so you're not leaning backwards. Your legs are either, if you're seated on the floor, you can be in a, what they call lotus, full lotus position, with both your feet crossed. For many of us, that is difficult. You can even do half lotus. And if you're seated in a chair, just be comfortable with your feet down. Your arms are relaxed, right? They're open here, they're not tight. And then your right palm is on top of your left, and your thumbs are touching. So you bring it about 2 or 3 inches below your navel, just so it's comfortable you're sitting there. Your jaw and mouth is open. It's not open, it's easy. It's not tight. And your tongue is on the top of your palate, behind the teeth. And your eyes are just slightly open. But if you find it difficult, you can close it. The only reason they do this is people meditate for a long time in those old days, and you don't want to be uncomfortable. You don't want underarms sweating. You don't want your jaw to get tightened up and then your back start hurting. So you want to scan your body and feel comfortable. Okay? Just start scanning your body and see if anything is tight, and just be in a state where you can now do a minute or two of a meditation, okay? And what you're going to do is you're going to focus on your breath. Breath is something neutral. We breathe all the time. And that's why, rather than that's your object of concentration, is your breath. And some people find it very comfortable by just focusing on the breath coming in and out of your nostrils. Some people feel comfortable when the stomach is going out, when you inhale, and in when you exhale, you can just focus on that movement. And the point is to concentrate on your breathing. Now, what will happen is at this time of the day, your mind will start to wander. Some people are able to do it without any problems, but if your mind wanders, just don't get entwined in those thoughts. You want to bring it back to your breath. That's the concentration. It starts to wander. You say, okay, I hope so. I can see you. But then come back to the breath. And that's the whole point. And so let's do that for about a minute. Okay. And while our minds are calm, let's set the intention for this session. So think for a moment, take the time to generate this motivation that is particularly appropriate, one that makes the most use out of this occasion. So motivate ourselves to make an effort to gain an understanding of emptiness, as was taught by Buddha in the lineage of great practitioners, such as Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti, Lama Tsongkhapa, and the rest up to the present. And the subject that's being taught is the actual antidote to all suffering, the means whereby enlightenment is attained. Something that is within our grasp because we have the mind and we can understand the antidote. And so if we apply ourselves, then there is no reason why we cannot attain this precious understanding and experience, the profound view. Not only will this ensure our liberation from suffering and the cause of suffering, but it will enable us to become a perfect cause of happiness for all living beings. And as much as possible, then generate the thought that by whatever means I must achieve this state of supreme enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. And therefore, I am going to listen and try to understand these teachings. We have to be flexible and understand what we can. What we don't understand now, we will later. And so we have to be patient with ourselves and develop our own pace. This is the part of practice of patience that the bodhisattvas engage in. They have to practice six perfections, one being generosity, second being morality, third being having patience, have joyful effort or enthusiasm, develop meditation or concentration, and then wisdom of emptiness. You can practice all six of these while sitting and listening today. You can practice generosity by listening because we are acquiring the knowledge in order to be able to have something to share with others. And you can practice morality by restraining the mind from engaging in a wrongful motivation for listening, such as listening for sake of increasing one's self-importance or restraining from jealousy. Patience, of course, is the ability to endure difficulties without getting upset. The main difficulty here is the discomfort of not understanding. And we have to endure these difficulties and make an effort. The solution is to practice patience. When you practice enthusiasm while listening and enjoying the teaching, enjoy the teachings by appreciating their value, such as how they can open the doors of happiness and develop all your abilities. At the same time, in the midst of all this analysis, you still have to practice concentration. It's possible that while this session is going on, if you analyze too much, you could lose track of what is being said. and your attention returns to the listening again, you could have lost the chain of thought. Therefore, you have to balance between the analysis and concentration, one of the skills to be developed. And then, of course, practice of wisdom while listening is discriminating the actual meaning of what is said from all the possibilities. This is the intelligence we apply when we think about what is said. The meaning of the words, both explicit and implicit. What the teacher is intending by the words, reasoning, examples, and stories. So there's a lot that you can accomplish by simply listening. So whatever you have been taught to help you increase your understanding, this is the opportunity to apply it. Okay, you can bring your attention back. Thank you. Motivation and dedication both are extremely important. We don't do anything unless we have an intent to do it. That's obvious, right? Think about it. If you want to go somewhere, you want to drive somewhere, you have to have an intent to go there. If you just sit and say, I want to go, you're not going to go, you're going to do it. And dedication is taking this energy that you've created and you're directing forward so that energy drives you to that. That's you're dedicating it and saying, I'm going to get there. And so that's the dedication. So it's very important in the start of a class or anytime you're doing any kind of practice to have an intention, at the end, you should dedicate it for all beings. Okay, so do it. So today's class, I wasn't able to cover some historical background, so we'll cover that. I think it's very important that you know the background. Why? Because you need to assure yourself that this teaching is coming all the way from Buddha down. Okay, this is not something we made up. Not somebody we sat in the corner in a room and wrote this. This is teachings from the sutras or discourses of Buddha himself and the lineage teachers. We'll talk about our lineage teacher, direct lineage teacher, Lama Tsongkhapa, who began the Gelug tradition, which we'll talk about. He'll have a few definitions. I always have definitions because when you're reading your homework or when you're reading your material, these words will pop up and some of them are technical, or they may have a Sanskrit or a Tibetan, or Tibetan nature, and then you want to know what they really mean. So it's good. We'll talk about 12 links, and I'll touch on that when we are there. We'll look at a wheel of life. We'll even, if time permitting, we'll go through Heart Sutra. And then there are a couple of topics like really understanding ignorance. What does that mean? Yeah, okay. And then we'll talk about our personal identity that we create, you know, and then we'll close with our meditation and dedication. Make sense? Okay, so I have to give credit to Thupten Pende, who actually wrote the syllabus for the FPMT for this particular module. And it's important to know he's also known as Jim Dougherty. He is instrumental in getting FPMT's master's program. I have some notes here. First teacher to actually teach Module 12. He also coordinated Geshe Studies program at Manjushri Institute in UK. And then he developed the master's program in Institute of Lama Tsongkhapa in Italy. So, and according to him, several Westerners learned to read Tibetan to translate unique terms, which now we are so thankful that we can now have better understanding and appreciation for these concepts. So it's important that we give him the credit for this. And so a lot of my learning from reading different books, but I've followed his Module 12 for FPMT. And again, the idea here is, we'll talk about Nagarjuna also in a minute. My slides keep on moving along. This program is to provide an integrated program of study. So not only you're learning, but there is a one part where you actually do integration practices. And I think if you're serious about it, that's one of the things you must do. And just know the benefit of this is that you're following the footsteps of great masters, such as the Buddha himself. And then you'll see a little bit about the lineage teacher, Nagarjuna, Chandragupta, Shantideva, and others. Okay? That's the goal for today. So let's start with Buddha himself. So I see from my side, Kishida, you know, I'm going to just talk about that. And I don't know if I should remove this, Linda, or just talk. It's okay.
It's up to you, Hemant.
Okay, well, this is a very, very general slide. Maybe I can just continue so I don't lose it. So Shakyamuni Buddha, as all you know, for his teachings on emptiness, sometimes it's called selflessness, egolessness, identitylessness, emptiness, so many different titles given to this topic. Then you think about Sanskrit, it's called Shunyata. And then you have Vietnamese and Chinese and all different terms. They all mean the same thing. And so, though you want to minimize some of this jargon, this subject has some technical aspects to it, and therefore those definitions are very important. And that's why I think it's important to have some of those definitions for you. And so the Buddha's teachings were vast. They're called sometimes 84,000 bundles. And he taught according to different disposition of different groups of people or the type of person that was in front of him. Right? And it was categorized into three baskets of teachings. One basket, bunch of his teachings, were for the discipline. That's called Vinaya. You don't need to know that, just a discipline. The second basket of teaching is discourses or sutras. And the third one was bucketed into what they call the teachings on knowledge or Abhidharma. Okay, just know the discipline, discourses, and knowledge. Then these teachings were further divided into two parts, the universal vehicle and what they call the individual vehicle. You may have heard Mahayana and Theravada or Hinayana. Okay, the universal teachings are for those disciples who are familiar with, who are the family of the great compassion. That is, those beings whose motivation is for developing and cultivating their potential on the spiritual path motivated by compassion. Thus, they are trying to become an instrument or a cause for happiness for others. Okay? And they follow this path called method. We'll talk about that. There are two wings in our Mahayana tradition. One is called the wisdom wing, where we learn about the emptiness. In the method, how do you function? What do you do? Well, you know, this is wonderful, but I need to function a certain way. And then there are six perfections, and in the meditation we went through those six perfections: generosity, morality, and morality has three parts: morality of restraint from committing non-virtuous actions of body, speech, and mind, creating merits and benefiting others. And then the third one is developing patience. Then we do this with joyful effort. Then you develop concentration or meditative equipoise. And finally, wisdom of emptiness, directly perceiving the wisdom of emptiness. Those are the things that we must, as in this valuable human life, we can do those things. So that's the method to achieve this liberation that we are seeking. Okay, on the individual side, okay, the teachings are geared for those practitioners who are motivated principally by the desire to escape from the vicious cycle of uncontrolled death and rebirth. But it's on an individual basis. They are not looking at the universal picture. It's simply on this individual basis. The Buddha provided teachings for that and a track to achieve that goal. In the individual vehicle or the teachings, you find, for instance, the Great Enlightenment Sutra, which describes the Buddha's achievement of enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. So you all know that he traveled for 40 years, he taught for 40 years, but in his quest to become enlightened, he searched and went through a lot of penance, but under the Bodhi tree, he was awakened. He realized he was enlightened. Okay? And what he noticed when he came out of enlightenment was he looked around. I have a great video, by the way, on this. And I see him that when he opened his eyes, and he looks around and he sees his entire, what he knew that everything starts from ignorance of not knowing how these things are, how reality is. So ignorance was. And from ignorance, we engage in actions. And from actions, we have consciousness arises, or mind. And then from consciousness, there is name and form, which we'll go into this a little bit more. And from the name and form, senses come up. And from senses, there is contact to the sense objects. And from contact arises feeling. And from feeling, we have craving. And from craving, we are grasping something you really want. And that's what you become, basically. And that's then the next one is you have a you become that, something that arises. And after that, that is the mind that then goes to the next birth. And then you start your cycle again. The propensity of this mind that you become kind of at some point goes, some piece of that goes with you. And then that's what happens the next life. That's where you are attracted to, right? So he saw that. And so it was very obvious from him, can you cut the root of the ignorance out? If you can only understand how reality truly is, then you don't have ignorance. And if you don't have ignorance, your actions are not arising. Those actions are not arising. And then, of course, there's a cessation of those, that kind of mind and so forth. It just goes the same thing that we talked about. It has a cessation. And if you're talking about the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering and there is cessation, right? And there's a reason for that. And then there's cessation and there's a path. So that's kind of the beginning of the Four Noble Truths. And this also talks about the 12 links. These things that I talked about, how he saw the ignorance arising, then the mind or consciousness arising, then the name and form. These are the 12 links that causes us to go into the cyclic birth and death. So we'll talk about that today, but I thought I'd at least mention that. So what's the point? So you know the 12 links and Buddha was awakened. And so what's the point? We see that the whole cyclic existence with all the sufferings is a result of uncontrolled ignorant actions, as well as clinging and grasping that occurs at the time of death. The grasping for continued existence causes a person to be reborn. And then once you're reborn, it's kind of too late. You start that whole cycle again. It's akin to you sitting in a dentist chair and say, oh, I should have flossed my teeth, but it's a little too late. Right? It's the same as that. So when you have this precious human rebirth, an opportunity to practice that method and practice the liberation of emptiness, that's why this topic is very important, to see how we can cut the root of that ignorance. And the only way to end that is to end the ignorance that is the root of all. And the only way to end is through wisdom, which I just said. And wisdom is basically a mental event that is able to discriminate between what is and what isn't. And here the discrimination is particularly the way things exist, by the means which we identify. And when we can eliminate those false appearances that obscure the actual mode of existence, then you can get liberated. So that's Buddha. So the teachings of emptiness is coming from Buddha. I'm also obligated to tell you that as the people were reading all these discourses, there are different thoughts and schools that came out of this. Somebody's trying to come in, you know? And I think you should know that, a little bit about that. So what happens was the Buddhist philosophical systems evolved, allowing, and you need to be familiar with it, and you need to also know why we follow a certain school. So first school was Vaibhashika. You don't need to know this name. This is for knowledge sake. Second was Sautrantika, Chittamatra, and that what the school we follow is Madhyamaka, the centrist view. And we'll talk a little bit about it. The first two schools, also called the Great Exposition, I think, are the schools that only say or assert only the selflessness of the person and not the selflessness of the phenomena. Only the person is selfless, but the phenomena exists. That's two schools. Then the Chittamatra thinks it's the mind only. Chitta is mind. Mind only. Everything is mind. So they also discredit any kind of existence. Madhyamaka, which is from Nagarjuna's teachings and discourses and coming from Buddha, very clearly, it's very important. So it has a major influence on subsequent development of this Mahayana Buddhist tradition. It is the dominant interpretation of Buddhist philosophy in Tibetan Buddhism, and also being the most influential in the East Asian Buddhist thought. So it talks about Sunya, and what it talks about is the one of the highest and the most subtle school. And the Madhyamaka view is that it's the middle way, because the position lies between what it sees as eternalism of the first two schools, and that sees object only, and it says nothing exists, while the Madhyamaka says things do exist. However, they don't exist the way we think they exist. Subtle changes like that. So don't get your mind wrapped around it right now. Just know that things do exist. They just don't exist inherently. And we will cover that in a little more detail. But I think I'm obligated to tell you, because as you're reading it and you may come across that, well, the thought here in Chitta Matra is so-and-so. You said, now what is this? Right? So you need to be familiar with it. Okay? So then we need to talk about Nagarjuna. So let's talk about that, a little bit about Nagarjuna. So he was somewhere in 150 CE to 250 CE, widely considered one of the most important Buddhist philosophers, a pioneer in lineage of Mahayana teacher, and is considered the founder of Madhyamaka school of Mahayana, as we just mentioned. Okay, so again, Madhyamaka is nothing but the middle way or centrists. That's the school tradition. And in the root verses of the middle way, Madhyamaka also refers to the ultimate nature of phenomena, as well as non-conceptual realization of ultimate reality, that is experience. This is where people get a little confused. Just know that things do exist. However, they don't exist the way we think they exist, and we will cover that in a minute. So Nagarjuna is also credited with developing philosophy of wisdom sutras and teachings, discourses. And he said there's a legend that there's a whole story on biography. When you have a time, you should look it up. You should just look up Wikipedia Nagarjuna, and there's a whole story on his biography. However, he wound up serving as an abbot of Nalanda University from 5th century to 12th century, if not the largest, one of the largest training facilities, and people from China and Turkey and all, Sri Lanka all came there to learn from his masters. And his main point was his focus and the concept was emptiness, okay, or shunyata, okay? And there was a legend that he found this doctrines or this sutras in this cave in Nepal, which is the temple called Swayambhunath, which is a monkey temple. So supposedly there's a cave, and there's some group called Nir people or Nagas, and he was told that this is where he will find, and he brought it from there, and he wrote a lot of his discourses based on that. It still is there. There's a cave, but they closed it. You can go to certain places, and you can see the frescoes and murals, but you can't go further. And there's some stories about some people have gone in and never come out, that thing. But that's what it said. So he also came up with the not self and dependent origination, that everything is dependent originating. Everything. For Nagarjuna, as for Buddha in his early texts, it is not merely sentient beings that are selfless or non-substantial. All phenomena are without intrinsic self-nature. So let's pause there for a second. I want you to think about that for a second. When you say interdependent, in this phenomena, everything is interdependent or dependent arising. It comes from its causes and conditions. Think of anything. Think of anything. Do you know anything that just statically appears? Your body, your organs, trees, tables, chairs, fruits, name it. Look at the phenomena, not only external, internal. everything is dependent on something or causes and conditions. So that's something to think about. And every time when I go through some of these things, what happens is you will lose the trap. Remember, we are learning about shunyata, how what reality is, how things are. And if you see things factfully, without any type of wrong assertions in your mind, which we are accustomed to, and that's why we have this suffering, then the idea is to undo that. And how do we get there? How do we really understand this properly? And it is a topic that requires listening, contemplation or analysis and meditating. There's no switch that says, oh, I went to a class and now I can see emptiness. It takes a little time, but at least we can put the seeds into that. And you can intellectualize it, correct? You can get a glimpse of it a little bit. And that's when you want to analyze and actually really analyze to see if this is true for you or not. Okay, so keep that in mind at all times. So even if you talk about somebody's history, somebody's background, the point is, it's important to know where it's coming from, who taught it, and what are they trying to teach us, and how we can incorporate it. That's the whole idea behind this. Okay, so then we'll get into class 3 or 4, next class or class after, where Nagarjuna uses very logical tools to refute contemporaries and becomes a prominent school of system that we follow. It is a school Gelugpa tradition follows from Dalai Lama down. It is the school Lama Tsongkhapa. So talk about the two, yes, before I go, he also talks about the two truths, how we exist relatively and how we don't exist intrinsically, which we'll cover also. So be familiar with that a little bit. Okay?
Hey, Amit, excuse me. We do have a question, if you're up for a question real quick.
Sure.
Okay. The question is, does state of shunyata itself exist independently?
No. Even emptiness is empty of inherent existence. Nothing is inherently existent. Now, if you want to, it's a little advanced thinking, which will cover it when you go through the logical tools. Everything is dependent arising. If a state of mind recognizes emptiness, that can change very quickly if your state of mind changes. The phenomena is the phenomena, right? So think about this way. You know how I think of phenomena from my just reading the homework material and the reading material. If you think of phenomena of string of causes and conditions, then temporarily things arise through those causes and conditions. And all we are doing is putting labels on it. And we think it's distinct. It is self, its essence is very distinct. And we apply that to things, people, everything. So it exists, but relatively, because it's the phenomena that's moving along. It does not have name. It does not have anything going on with it. It is simply what it is. That's how things are. So we'll cover that in a little more detail. Maybe that will clarify the idea of is emptiness. They even say sometimes, don't get latched onto emptiness with an attachment either, because that creates another I. Just look at it for what it is. It is what we are changing is how we are seeing the fact. Think about how many things we make conjecture, wrong apprehension. And we'll cover that with anger and hatred and all that. We'll cover those topics are there. And what I wanted to also cover is just to while we are talking Nagarjuna, I'll say for the question that was answered, sunyata is often misunderstood to mean that nothing exists. This is not so. Okay, instead, it tells us that there is existence, but that phenomena are empty of intrinsic essence. This Sanskrit word means self-nature or self-existence. Although we may not be conscious of it, and we tend to think things as having some essential nature, if we look at, for example, two examples here. let's look at some plastic and metal. And we put it together, becomes a toaster. When you really look at it, the toaster is not in the plastic, nor it is in that metal. It is something we put together, so it exists. We label it toaster. There is no toasterness in either metal or the plastic. Another example, there was a story actually in the teachings where Nagasena is one of the sages, meets a Bactrian charioteer king. And he says, why don't you disassemble your chariot? And then when he disassembles it, he says, now show me where the chariot is. So the teacher says, well, the king says, maybe I see the unassembled chariot. Or the parts is in us. So we think like that. Well, I'm still here. I'm here. So the point is, there is no chariotness in any of those parts. It is simply a name to given parts. Okay? So that's what we need to really grapple in our mind. What is it trying to say? That if the whole idea is that you may be wondering if the inherent nature of chariots and toasters matters to anyone. The point is that the most of us perceive reality as something populated to many distinctive things and beings, right? That's what we do. We create he, she, it, and names. Instead, think of phenomena as a vast ever-changing of causes and conditioner appearances. What we see as distinctive, but are temporary conditions. This is just to put it in a very simplistic form of a temporary condition. So this leads to the teachings and talking about dependent origination. Right? So Nagarjuna would say things exist, but they don't exist the way we think they exist. They exist relatively. Is it making sense a little bit? I want to make sure that we are not too lost at this point. These words, emptiness, relative, ultimate truth, relative truth, can sometimes itself throw you off a little bit. But you keep it very simple, and I want you to pause now and then in your mind and think how things exist. It's not static, not inherent. That's one thing you got to come up with in mind. But things do exist because the phenomena and causes and conditions are there. We simply label these things and we see it as distinct, or that's the way it is by itself. We don't see the phenomena of absolute nature. And that's where, now, the second piece you can think about is, we are always talking about an example of a cup and a toaster and a chariot, but that applies to you. It's not all external. We have that I exist. Hemant is here. Ninda is there. Right? Paula is there. Dinesh is there. But you take the name away for a moment. If I call somebody from some small island and says, call the Dinesh or call Ninda, he's going to look around. What are we talking about? But we conventionally agree that we will see this being as Linda. So conventionally, he exists. We feel joy, we feel pain. Nobody's taking that away. But you need to have the other view, absolute nature of things. Is there Linda, has Linda-ness in her? No, she has body and has parts, organs, feelings. Those are all different parts. We defined last class the five aggregates. Form, feeling, discrimination, mental thinking or volitions, and consciousness. They are also themselves devoid of inherent existence. But they exist. You know, they're there. We just need to keep a name. So if once you get that thinking in your mind, you need to contemplate on it. You need to understand that and see if it twists your mind a little bit. But once it falls in place, you can intellectualize it and then meditate on it. Okay, so let's go forward. So, nice slide here. Maybe we can clarify some of these things. So what does Nagarjuna say? He says, I prostrate to the perfect Buddha, the best of teachers, who taught that whatever is dependently arising is unceasing, means what? It's continuous, does not stop. It's unborn, unannihilated, means it cannot be destroyed. It's not permanent. Think about it. Everything is changing. You are changing. The minute you started the class till now, you aged that many moments. Everything. Nothing is permanent. Everything is impermanent, right? Think about it. Trees, leaves. Now the fall will come, the leaves will change. They'll fall, new leaves will come up. We are all changing. The carpet you're sitting on is changing. The chair you're sitting on is aging. Your car is aging. Everything is impermanent, right? So it's not destroyed, not permanent, okay? Not coming or going without distinction, without identity, and free from conceptual distinction. Okay? Only we give it the concept, right? We give the name. That is the carpet. It's a red carpet. Conventionally correct, nothing wrong. It's a valid cognition. It's valid to say it that way. You can say, I am going to go and have a cup of tea. That's perfectly fine. But you got to have that mind that recognizes how reality is in when you look at the ultimate truth of how things are. Okay? So for Nagarjuna, dependent arising is one side of the coin. The other side is emptiness. It is basically the same in essence. If things are dependent arising, they arise, though they exist. They keep on moving along. We just come in and kind of identify a few things and say, ah, that's a cup, that's a glass. And they are called conventional because we have agreed that we're going to talk with each other. And when I say a tree, you can recognize the tree. That's all. But when you look at it, does it exist on its own? No. It needs water, it needs soil, it needs seed, it needs sunlight, it needs causes and conditions. It goes on and on and on. So it's changing and important. Okay, enough of that. A little bit on Chandrakirti, very quick. This Chandrakirti, again, was a commentator and a logician, and he was a disciple of Nagarjuna, and it is said that his teachings are very, very powerful. And if we were to ask who the commentator, which one should I read? And he says, Nagarjuna, the commentator, read Chandrakirti. Okay. He's seen by the Tibetan Buddhists as offering the most thorough and accurate vision of Nagarjuna's emptiness, which represents the final truth of the Buddha's teaching. Then you may have heard of Shantideva, right? Have you seen this book, The Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life? He was in, I think, 8th century CE, Indian philosopher, Buddhist poet, and considered one of the 84 Mahasiddhas. In other words, Siddhas are people who have realized being. They have attained, they have attainments because of their practices, and also follows in the lineage of her teachings on emptiness. And finally, must mention Lama Tsongkhapa. Okay. Great Tibetan master, again, a prolific writer, a realized being, right? And he is the beginning of our Gelugpa tradition, the largest of the traditional schools. And his practice and realization was so great that he was able to communicate with Manjushri, a Buddha of wisdom. And he asked one time through his practice, tell me, which teachings on reality should we follow? He said, he was given the instruction, Nagarjuna's. And then he asked, whose commentaries should I follow? It's just Chandrakirti. So the point here is that we are following the lineage from Buddha all the way down. Okay, so it that needs to stay in your mind. This is not some Hemant making it up or somebody teaching you something different. It needs to be, you need to ensure yourself these are Buddha's teachings coming down. So the question here is, he says, Buddha, Chandrakirti says, Buddhas come from bodhisattvas. So then the question is, what is a bodhisattva? Well, first of all, bodhisattva is one thing. the mind of a bodhisattva is bodhicitta. So who can tell me what is a bodhicitta? Anybody?
If you'd like to answer, just feel free to unmute.
It's placing others' needs before your own.
Very good. Who was that? I'm not able to see you.
Nico.
Oh, Nico. Thank you very much, Nico. So if you look at the Lama Yeshe archives and look at the actual meaning, this is exactly what it is, what Nico just said. But to make it elaborated, it's a principle consciousness that combines the two factors of wishing to free all beings from suffering and wishing to attain enlightenment in order to achieve that. So it's a spontaneous altruistic mind of enlightenment, can be either aspirational or engaging. In other words, you want to benefit others, just like Nico said. Okay, so that's bodhicitta. And a bodhisattva is a person that has that mind. Bodhicitta. Okay, so Chandrakirti says Buddhas come from bodhisattvas. Okay. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about was, before we get into the actual the meat of this teaching, is you might have read your homework about non-duality. Anybody get a chance to at least look through some of those readings, one, two pagers? So just understand, when you see this word non-dual, things are non-dual. All we are saying is, us, internal and external, things exist. So it's not nihilistic, nothing exists, things are blank, and it doesn't say things. And the other side is, things exist concretely or self-essence. So the middle way is non-dual way of looking at things, okay? Not one extreme or the other. And it's important that we are always keeping ourselves balanced and thinking in the middle. Okay, so, all right. So the next thing I want to talk about is, according to Lama Tsongkhapa, these are the three principal aspects of the path, teaching by Lama Tsongkhapa. Here's the book, just in case I'm not, again, promoting it. I just want you to know there's a lot of readings that you can find. This is called The Three Principal Aspects of the Path by Geshe Sonam Rinchen, who is teaching you. So what it's saying is, the three things required for your enlightenment. One, you must be motivated to renunciate samsara. Nobody's selling to cut your hair and wear a saffron robe monk and sit in the cave. That's not the point of renunciating. That's one way. Renunciating means your eagerness to not be born again and again and again and go through all this suffering, pain, aging, death, and all that. Again, there's recycling in this samsara. So renunciation. Second one, you need to have the method of practice bodhicitta benefiting others. We talked about bodhisattva. So you need to develop bodhisattva. But then take a look at this, what Manjushri tells Lama Tsongkhapa. He says, you may master renunciation with the wish to achieve supreme enlightenment, but unless you have the wisdom perceiving reality, you cannot cut the root of cyclic existence. So make efforts in the ways and to perceive interdependence. So three principal aspects of the path are renunciation, liberation or emptiness, wisdom of emptiness, and developing bodhicitta. Extremely important. Again, emptiness is the middle of everything, see? So, how can this be an antidote to the obstacles to liberation? So let's think about it. The direct realization of an experience of emptiness is an actual antidote to the obstacles. You are not able to liberate yourself because we have obstacles in our mind stream. Okay? So let's talk about that. The idea is to remove these obstacles, eliminate them, okay? And what you need to have this wisdom in order to achieve liberation, okay? So the first part is you intellectualize it, right? You kind of, when we're talking, you kind of think about it, okay? wait a minute, I'm not here existing, but I am existing. And all these thoughts will come to your mind. All you got to see is phenomena, causes and conditions. Things are interdependent. Things come into being. You can call it, in your own words, maybe temporarily, we label something like that, but we are always changing and moving along. And then we identify that as permanent or something substantial. That's all. And because of that, all kind of problems begin. We saw that in the quick 12 links. That once you have that ignorance, you know, and then you have a mind, then what happens? The I gets in there. Once the I feels like I am solid, I am me, and I'm by myself, independent, I'm permanent, all of a sudden, attachment, aversion, desire, all of these things is what I want. Whenever you have the sense and the feelings and then the grasping and the craving, when the I does not get something it wants, it is not pleasurable, is it? And then, and think about that, for example, you know, when you are grasping onto something, and what the one of the link before the last, the birth is becoming, those are the thoughts you have in your mind. If somebody were to ask you, who are you? Think about for a second. Who are you? You may take out a license and say, I am John. I'm him. Now think about it. Is that you? That's your license. It's a name, him. For John. For India. Who are you? When you are about to die, see if you're grasping onto a bunch of anger. That's what you become. What will happen? That's the thought that will come. If you have a strong desire, that's what you latch onto. Then you have the corresponding condition now to move that onto the next. Back in that cycle again. Right? So you can liberate from that once you know how to see things. So when you subdue or eliminate this root nature that we have of looking for that, we'll be doing that at some point, but the I or self-existence is permanent and not changing, then we are stuck here. So can you think about that for a second? But you must have a determination that I'm going to figure this out and I'm going to know it. Right? And how do you know this? First, you listen just like you are. Some things will stick in, some things will go away. Don't get frustrated. Remember the motivation. Don't get upset. Just relax. But be determined. You'll find that our mind is amazing. Think about where you learn to drive. You learned. We all learn things all the time if you put an effort in it. Right? So what you do is you listen, then you think about it, then you analyze it. And when you analyze it, and some things will stick in it, it will come in. You keep that for a while. Analyze it further if you want. And then meditate on it, make it part. That's when you start to clear the obstacles out. When that is gone, when that I is gone, you will be considered, you have liberated yourself. Okay? It doesn't say it will take 3 eons to liberate yourself. Many of these yogis will realize being in this life, and you can too. It's just about the effort you put in. We've been practicing this permanent me and I for a long, long, long time. It's very difficult to undo that. Our systems are also geared towards fulfilling the I. Job, certificates, titles, right? Everything is praise. Somebody choose you out, upset, blame them. Oh, we live in it all the time, don't we? But you got to have this belief. Now you have to put it in your system and absorb the fact how things are and know that these are relative truths, things are happening. And I'll give you a good example in one of the stories. This guy is giving something to the, is saying all these bad words to Buddha. He's visiting a town and asking for alms. And this person is just throwing things at him and saying, oh, you beggar, and this and that. And one of the disciples is thinking, saying, Buddha, how come you're not affected by this? And Buddha Buddha said it very simply. He says, when somebody gives you something and you don't take it, where does that thing belong? He says, it belongs to the person who was giving you. So he says, when somebody's throwing things at you and I'm not accepting it, it's not mine, it's theirs. See, simple teachings like that are there that tells you that we take it too much because the I is very strong, and that's what gets bruised very quickly because of attachments. So anyways, definition times. So let's take a look at what are true truths. Conventional or relative truth. You must have had some glimpse of it now. Okay, so think about what is that? What is the true? What is true to be valid conventional consciousness? Valid meanings. I can see this is a glass. This is a valid cognition. It is a glass. Okay? Yeah, you agree, I agree, we see it, we use it. That's called recognition. So that's, but it's also called a concealer truth or obscuring truth because it obscures the ultimate nature. The ultimate nature requires that they're not, the glass is not truly existent. There's no glassness in it. It's glass, molecules, sand, so many other molecules, atoms and things that have put this thing here, and we call it a glass conventionally to identify that this is a glass. I can talk to you, you can talk to me, and we can say, hey, cheers, you know. But the ultimate mind says, yeah, but everything, if you look at it, some person put it together, somebody molded it, somebody used all these chemicals and sand and glass, pieces of other plastics and stuff, and made this glass. It goes on and on and on. That's how phenomena is. It's just impermanent and always causes in conditions that bring something in front of you. So you can say the glass exists, but does not exist on its own. There is no glassness in that glass. It's simply an object, and we call it, label it glass. So you got to put that in your perspective and think through that a little bit. Okay, so that's what ultimate truth is. Understanding the ultimate nature of reality, of things that are empty of true existence. Because then we talked about method and wisdom. I covered that a little bit. So the method is the two wings, method and wisdom, is the emotional compassionate side associated with development of kindness and compassion and bodhicitta. Okay, and it supports the wisdom of emptiness. So we talked about generosity, morality, patience, joyful effort, and all that, right? Now the wisdom side is the logical side, right? More cerebral. You look at the nature of reality. In the wisdom of emptiness, which frees us from the cyclic existence. Why? Because we are liberated. We know how things are. We see things in a very certain way now, how things exist. There is no feeling of this, I'm going to get so mad, I'm going to get so, you know, not overly exaggerated, not underly exaggerated. Just look at the facts. So in order to attain Buddhahood, practitioners must engage in both method and wisdom. Why? Because you are here at this point, and you have a chance as you're changing to old age, and at one point you will pass on. Here's an opportunity, if we call it the precious human rebirth, is to change the course, see things the way they are, and subdue this holding on. That's the whole idea, right? Okay? So that's that. All right, let's see. Ignorance. We've been talking about ignorance almost all evening in the last class. So literally means what? You can read that, of course. Not seeing that which exists. In which things exist, right? And there are two kinds of ignorance. Ignorance of karma and ignorance of ultimate truth. Karma plays a big role because what you practice, remember I felt, then you have the propensity for the next birth based on how your karma is, what you're creating in your own, you're infusing your mind with, right? So karma plays a role. Yeah. And it's a fundamental delusion from which all others spring. And it's the first of the 12 links of dependent origination, which we kind of talked about a little bit, and we'll cover it next So these are your 12 links. If you read different books, you may see it sometimes a little more complex. Each one leads to some other branches and comes back. This is a linear way of just giving you a good example of what it is. So you need to think about it. This is what Buddha realized when he was when he attained his Buddhahood. These are the things he came quickly to. He knew now, he was a Buddha now, that everything starts from ignorance. So ignorance is not just lack of understanding how everything actually exists, but mistakenly knowing that all phenomena have inherent or intrinsic existence. That's number one. We've been talking about that all night. The second piece is called compositional actions or creating karma. Due to this fundamental ignorance, beings are engaged, are engaging and will engage in all the actions of body, speech, and mind, right? Which has potential to compose, create, or create future suffering, like a future rebirth. The third one, what they call consciousness, which is causal and resultant. Each time an action is created from before one before, the potential for that action to produce future rebirth also takes place, depending on the actions you take, or the mind you develop, I mean. Right? And that kind of thinking, that action creates this mind, you infuse your mind with those things. And that is the beginning of what they call name and form. Name meaning mind, form probably is the body, physical aggregates, what we are made up of, form, feeling, discrimination, or mental thinking and consciousness. That's what we call aggregates, sometimes called the heaps. Then what happens after that? The six sense spheres. So we have the body mind has is developing. Now we have the six senses gradually coming to form, sense power, right? The eye consciousness, then we see the form. Ear consciousness, then we hear sounds, right? And then because of those senses, we have contact. We can feel, touch, distinguish, unpleasant, pleasant, neutral. Then the feeling starts. Again, happiness, unhappiness, indifference, they arise.
Can you go over what dependent orientation is again, please?
Say that again.
Can you go over what dependent orientation is again, please?
Okay, sure. You want me to go over the compositional action or consciousness, and maybe I'm not understanding you?
I'm just not clear what dependent orientation is.
Oh, dependent origination. I get it. That all things are dependent on other causes and conditions. Everything. I'll give you a very mundane example. We talked about it in last class. Look at a tree. Or look at a body, whatever you want to take a look at it. Look at how things are dependent on other things. For a tree to be there, it needs water, it needs whatever minerals. It had to have a seed. All those things to have must have causes and conditions, good sunlight, good water, right? You can go on and on and on. And that seed had to have the causes and conditions to then turn into and with the causes and conditions become a tree. That seed had to come from another fruit. That fruit had to come from another tree. Keep going. And same thing with us. You look at your organs. You need blood. You need food for the blood. Where does the food come from and go on backwards? You need fluids, the water. You need the elements like heat, fire, earth elements, minerals. Everything is dependent origination, originating. We are dependent on each other. The phenomena is interdependent.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
It makes sense now?
Much better. Yes, thank you.
Okay, great. Okay, so now we have a feeling, you know, feeling of pleasantness, unpleasantness. And now I like this feeling, so we have craving. I want it more often. Then you grasp at that feeling and you become that person because that's infused in your mind. And then when you take birth, that's the person you, there's a seeds in there for that propensity is there. And then this cycle starts again, accumulating more stuff. That's what keeps us going. And what it starts with is not knowing why this is happening. Right? So ignorance is the root cause. And it is depicted in this picture. And you might have seen this when you go to Kadampa Center or any other monastery. You will see that usually on the entrance. Yeah? In very short, we talk about the three poisons, ignorance, aversion, and attachment. Let's consider the three poisons. That's what keeps us grasping and craving for things. They are depicted in the center by three animals. I'm not going to go into what each animal and everything stands for, but just understand that. Then based on your actions, if you have a good karma, you're still in samsara. The next circle shows leading to the upper realms, god realms, demigod realms, human realm. Depending on the karma, you can also go into animal realm, ghost realms or hell realms, state of mind. Okay, then these are not planets like Pluto somewhere. Okay. Now, then what is covered next? So let's make sure I tell you all the things. So you can see where the contented people go, and then this is what happens in the other half. Then these are the six realms. So it talks about the six realms. Then there are 12 sections in this outer realm. So these are corresponding locations you go to based on your karma. And then the last one are the 12 links. This we talked about starts with the ignorance, consciousness, actions, right? All those things that we talked about are in the 12 links. And what he's saying is this is the wheel of samsara. We always are running in circles in this wheel all the time, from birth to death to the next birth. Okay,
Mitt, we have a question from a student on YouTube.
Okay.
The question is, does dependent origination only pertain to samsara? Does this phenomenon stop when we get liberated? What is this phenomenon called, liberation?
Okay. Liberation is mostly talks about, is associated with the word nirvana. If you look at the individual vehicle, this person is basically has realized emptiness, is liberated, is can perfectly stay in that voice. They still carry very subtle individual because it's still I-oriented, right? My own liberation. And they say the higher liberation is enlightenment, where all obscurations are completely gone and you are omniscient and omnipresent. You have the full awareness and you're able and have the power to do anything whenever you want. That is the Buddha nature. That's the resume. That's what we are trying to do. So liberation, you can still liberate yourself in emptiness, but they say that there could be still very, very subtle individualities left, but you can still liberate yourself. However, when you go to become enlightened, you have conquered all of that. That's what I understand. And if that person wants to talk privately, we can talk a little more details on what is that. But just to at least get an idea.
Thank you, Hayman.
No problem. So this talks about there is a path and Buddha is pointing that you can be liberated. He's pointing. He's saying, you can seize this cyclic existence. So this is a whole picture, okay, of the wheel of life.
There's one more follow-up question.
Sure.
So when we get liberated at the highest level, there is no dependent origination?
It's a very good question. You have recognized the emptiness at that point. you have completely mastered emptiness at that point. You've enunciated and you've realized being in that way. So you've liberated your mind. So at that point, when you've recognized emptiness, there is not dependent origination. Your awareness is very different at that point. Okay? It's totally different. But when they say the stages of the bodhisattva, at the sixth stage, they reach this complete knowledge and manifest stations of understanding of emptiness before they reach complete enlightenment, where everything at that point is fully aware. Your mind is aware and knowing. It knows all. So there is a minor distinction between nirvana. There's a distinction between nirvana and enlightenment, or higher nirvana. So dependent origination really applies in this samsaric life cycle. But once you get out of that, then there should be no reason to have dependent origination. Things are, the phenomena still continues to be dependent origination, but you're aware of it. You see it. You cannot say it does not exist. Phenomena exists. It is that now you see it, how things are, the way they are. That's why you're liberated. That doesn't stop the phenomena, right? Make sense? Am I clear? Do we need to discuss more on that?
I think you're good, man.
Okay. I have 5 minutes. We're going to touch Heart Sutra just a little bit, and then we'll go to meditation. And then we'll finish off some of these Heart Sutra. So, I don't know if you can read it or not. If you have the Golden Prayer Book, I'm sorry, mine is marked up like this. But on page 76 of the Essential Buddhist Prayers is the Heart of Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. This is the quintessential teaching of emptiness. And what I'll do is, rather than reading it, maybe we'll start next time by reading it, but we'll at least get to the main point. This is the entire piece of Heart Sutra. So we'll go from here. So this Buddha is seated on this perfect location, good times, bodhisattvas are seated, and while he's in complete equipoise, concentrated, this conversation takes place between Sariputra and Avalokiteshvara, two bodhisattvas, but now we know Avalokiteshvara has changed ways with Buddha of compassion. So it starts with the fact that it was an excellent place, excellent teacher, excellent disciples. And this conversation takes place. And at the time of Avalokiteshvara looked upon this very practice, and he's questioning, how should any son of lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of profound perfection of wisdom? This is a question. And the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara said this to Sariputra. Sariputra, any son of lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of this profound perfection of wisdom should look at this way, correctly, repeatedly, beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Okay? And then they have a statement, form is empty, emptiness is form, form is nothing other than emptiness is nothing other than form. Form, feeling, discrimination, and consciousness are empty of inherent existence. And then to shorten it, of course, there's a lot more to it. So when you read this and you will say, there is nothing coming, nothing going, no nose, no eye, think about it. These are labels. Okay, these are simply labels. That's why they say that. They're not saying that there is no senses. It's simply not there. You see it the way things are factfully. And then at the end, this mantra, which is a powerful mantra, summarizes that as tayatha gate gate paragate parsamagate bodhisoha. Basically, thus said, gone, gone, gone beyond, gone way beyond. Soha, so be it. This is summarizes the whole Heart Sutra. One must read the Heart Sutra. If you're interested, you should read it. There's, again, sorry to show you this, but there's a lot of reading material on that. Here's His Holiness's Dalai Lama's Heart of Wisdom Teaching, Essence of Heart Sutra. There's a lot of connection to the paths of Bodhisattva in some of these paragraphs. It has a lot more to this than just a simple little two paragraphs or three paragraphs I shared with you. So I wanted to make sure that there's maybe some justice to it. Okay, so with that, we'll go to the meditation now. Okay? So before we go, does it make sense? Is it beginning to make sense? You will still have some questions, and certainly we can have that discussion at some point in the class, because we have a short time. I always wind up at the end of the class. If you want to, you can certainly have my email. We can always chat, and we can go into it in more detail. And if I don't know, certainly Geshe-la and our Geshe-s are there to even get you more knowledge as you need it. So we have a lot of sources to give you the correct answer. Okay, so make sure of that. The point is to understand how reality is, and that's the whole point. So with that, just get in that position again of meditation. And I'm going to go by it very quickly. Sorry. Okay. Again, we already have talked about back straight, legs crossed or seated, how your jaw should be relaxed, where the tongue should be behind the teeth, eyes slightly open, nice, you take a nice deep breath, do 21 count of deep breaths. Count each breath out, and you exhale and inhale one, exhale and inhale two, exhale and inhale three. Just do about 20, 21 of those. So as we meditate, although the physical posture is important, the posture of our mind is also important to ensure productive meditation. So by mental posture, I mean a mind that is properly motivated. I also mean a mind that is neither scattered nor dully fixated. So set your motivation by recalling that you have the potential to be free of every fault and have the perfection of every quality. If you realize this potential, you will experience supreme happiness forevermore. Also, you will effortlessly lead others to the same attainment, as there is no better attainment than this. We must do whatever we can to actualize it. That is why we are practicing this meditation. So clear your mind of scattering and dullness by just quickly counting five breaths. Now imagine that your body is shutting down. Your sight dims and eventually goes all together. There is not even the appearance of the back of your eyelids. Your hearing grows faint until all outer sounds and even the sounds of your body disappear. Now you lose the sense of taste and your body grows numb. And you no longer feel the weight, the temperature, soft or smooth, hard or rough. You lose the sense of the body movement. And your senses of smell leaves. Meanwhile, your thoughts are changing. As your senses grow dim and your thoughts appear more clearly, like clear dream, familiar images. However, they all appear equal, as if you have become a detached observer. Your experience of these mental objects become neutral, that is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And you lose the ability to recognize these objects, but you forget their names. And you sort of lose even the sense of caring what is going on, or that there is purpose or anything. So the point is, you let go of the stream of thoughts, and there is no reason to hold on to it. So the thoughts fade away into darkness and disappear altogether. There is an illumination like night of full moon. Be aware of this without naming it or thinking about it, like an alert stare of an infant. Imagine the white illumination gives way to red illumination, like the sky of or sunset. Stare at it with intense awareness. Imagine that the light fades away into darkness, and the darkness grows deeper until it's absolute. And although there is nothing there, notice there is awareness. Notice how transparent it is, like clear crystal. And notice there is no center or periphery, no subject, no object, distinction. Stay in this clear awareness. When you can no longer hold your attention within the state of this utter simplicity, at least notice how concepts form, starting with the subject-object, you and the object. Notice how this distinction provides a basis for identifying characteristics, such as appearance, purpose, identities, and feelings. And notice how grasping at that reality of all that leads to more solidity until awareness is directed through physical sense doors and connects with the physical objects. So what we were doing through this meditation was gaining insight into the nature of ourselves. So let's dedicate, determine that you will build on whatever insight you might have gained through the class tonight and this meditation until you achieve the supreme insight. and dedicate your efforts to become a perfect cause for happiness of all beings. Thank you.
Thank you, Hemant.
Okay, the next session preview. There was one or two things I want to cover, which are very small pieces that I'll cover next time on anger and hatred and the self-identity. And then but next time we'll do this four-point analysis, which is a logical way where we look for the I. Okay. The person that we believe we are. Then we'll do the meditation on the I and the four-point analysis if possible, depending on the timeline. And then we'll dedicate. But we'll get a little more logical. So right now, we covered the background. We ensured that the lineage teachings were there. You have some really good concepts from Nagarjuna. You understand what we are trying to do, that things do exist. However, they don't exist the way we think they exist. Because things are always, the phenomena is always moving, right? It's always impermanent. It's always changing. And due to causes and conditions, things come up. But then we label it and we call it that's real. So think of those things, that things do exist, but they don't exist the way sometimes we think. We need to have two kinds of thinking going on. Relatively, conventionally, we can see things and identify things, but also know the real nature. So we talked about that a little bit today. We went through how Buddha realized how ignorance is the root of all the problems we have, and it keeps us in circles of samsara. So you identified that. And the whole point all along was, if we can just grapple and understand this understanding of emptiness that Buddha has taught us, and big sages like Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti and Lama Tsongkhapa have given us so much teachings on this, that we take a make a real effort to understand it and absorb it in our mind. And so that was that. And then we looked at Heart Sutra very shortly. If time permitting, we will cover it a little bit more. And then we did the meditation, and that was a self-awareness, sort of like a death process you go through. When things go away, you can still be aware of awarenesses. You lose the concept. Okay? So it was a great, great meditation in that way. So that was all I have for today. I will stick around for a few minutes if somebody wants to chat, but that will be the class for today, and it's exactly 8:30.
Hey, Mitt, do you have specific homework for this week?
You know, yes. I had asked people last time to read the non-duality, mm-hmm. right? And then we have talked about reading Seeking the I, right? I want you to continue to read the next one, that's a Mahamudra, and how to meditate on emptiness.
Okay.
But I want you, please read, because I cannot do justice with the details involved and examples given by Lama Tsongkhapa Rinpoche and so forth. They've done a wonderful job of explaining what that I is. So when you do a four-point analysis, it will only augment your thinking and allow you to learn even better. So it's not a lot of reading. If you really take your time, you can knock out within half an hour two of the readings. They're very small, 3 pages. What is non-duality, Seeking the I, and all those, and the two truths.
Okay.
Those were the homework for last time. If you've not done it, please read that, but move on to reading the Mahamudra.
Okay.
And Lama Yeshe. Fantastic reading.
All right. Okay.
And the books are there. I have mentioned the books that you should read. I don't know if they can download virtual reality from Yeshe Archive or not. I don't know. But these are available through Lama Yeshe Library. They're usually free. And they may ask you for a small donation. But it looks like this. Sometimes in Kadapa Center, they're on a little counter or a pedestal, and you can just pick up how things exist. This is one of them. And this is the reading of Virtue and Reality. These are very skinny books.
Mm-hmm.
Great. If you're traveling, going someplace, pick it up and read it. I think it will really help you, because I cannot do justice as Rinpoche has given us so much knowledge here, and the teachers have given us so much information, beautiful information here.
Yeah, and just to reiterate what Hemant just said, those are available on the Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive website, as well as if you happen to be on site at Kadampa Center, you can pick those up there as well.
Oh, cool. Okay.